So I'll try and set up the class a little bit, or the time together while we're doing handouts. The book is Richard Bauckham's book, which is what we're working from. It's called Bible and Politics. Bauckham is a superb, well-respected, very well-respected New Testament scholar. He sort of is usually, his stuff is usually talked about sort of in the same conversations as N.T. Wright or Oliver O'Donovan, guys like that, if that makes any sense. He's an excellent scholar who is not afraid to lean into when the evidence goes towards in traditional directions. He's not afraid to lean into when it doesn't, to be honest, but neither is he, as some scholars seem to be, afraid to affirm that when the biblical evidence takes us in certain directions, he's not at all afraid to lean into that. And so that's why he has sort of that N.T. Wright, Oliver O'Donovan sort of air about him. He's really, really well qualified and a believer as well. So his book then, these are sets, so each set goes to a person.
Okay.
So he wrote a book that he would say is a book where he wants to set up principles for reading the Bible so that it can be applied to political situations. Now, it's a book that does have a number of there's one page with just the Leviticus text, and then there's one of five pages. So what I've tried to do is, So the way the book is organized is the beginning of the book has principles of interpretation, which he then applies to various particular situations. And what I've done then is we could spend the entire time on any one chapter, on the interpretation parts, on any one section of a chapter. So what I'm hoping will work is this. The notes themselves have a lot of Bauckham's quotes. And that is partly because my life blew up and I didn't have a lot of time to process it. So I've given you a ton of quotes. But we'll try and walk through the quotes such that it gives you a sense of how Bauckham sees us using scriptural interpretations. Sorry, guys. Thanks. Sorry. So we'll try to walk through using the principles and then applying them to one particular text that I'll bet we're familiar with and maybe have processed before, which is that of Leviticus 19, about the not beginning to the ends of your fields. And then looking at that as a way of thinking about early in Bauckham can lead us towards thinking about obligations, personal and societal and political, to the poor, right, and to the sojourners. So if you look at the first text is Leviticus 19. So just to set up the text, you'll see the word Lord, or I am the Lord, or I am the Lord your God, peppered throughout the text. So Bauckham would say to us, first of all, for this chapter then, which is fairly unique in the book of Leviticus because it's a real hodgepodge of stuff. It's not all that coherent within the one chapter, unlike other chapters of Leviticus. But they say then within the chapter itself, and the repetition of this is really significant because it keeps the focus really as much on God as it does any one of these pieces. And it's a bit of a hodgepodge, really, this chapter. Lots of things going on. So if there's an overarching focus, then it's going to be on God himself because of this repeated thing. And this often comes at the end of the hodgepodge of admonitions is this, I'm the Lord your God. So Bauckham's saying, look, this is implying that whenever you read any one of these, that at the end of the thing it says, I'm the Lord your God, the implication is, and it seems obvious, but I'll go ahead and put it out there the way Bauckham does, is that these are true because God is our God. Right? Whatever he says is most true because we belong to God, we are holy, and therefore work it backwards. If he is holy and he is our God, then these things must, implementing these things must in some way reflect the fact that we belong to him more than anything else. And it's peppered throughout there. And so, and then at the very beginning, there's an underline in verse 2 that Bachman would offer is sort of the theme of the entire chapter. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then follows sentences, again, of hodgepodge stuff. So being holy and belonging to God and living in ways that reflect his character is sort of the key interpretive piece here. So before you get to how does gleaning my fields to the edges apply to anything else, or how does it, for that matter, offering a peace sacrifice or anything, how is this relevant? It's first relevant because in some way, which we may not know at the very beginning, we may take some work, in some way it's because it reflects that we belong to this God. And it is his personality that's being played out in our obedience some way. And I feel like I'm very far away, but Linda asked me to kind of be near this thing. Sorry, I'm not trying to be like a distant lecturer or something. Midway through, he has this this piece at the middle of the section that we're going to be most interested in, in verse 18. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people. Now, this is at the end of a paragraph that itself within the chapter is reflecting on social relationships. He says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But why is that important? Because I am the Lord. You love them because this is what my character looks like, and you belong to me, and this is how it gets played out. So this is the kind of the whole mental map for the chapter. We belong to God. When we belong to him, our lives reflect him. And when they reflect him, some of the illustrations are these things that we're about to read. So he's also going to make an important point in this part of the text that the law functions in many ways by way of general concept and illustration, right? Which is different from general concept and prescription, right? If you have a general concept and then you view your next 10 steps as, man, this is what you have to do to fulfill that concept, that's a different thing than to say, here are examples of what life looks like when you're fulfilling that concept. So it's a different way of reading this. And sometimes we can read it as like, oh, good, I've got 10 verses, 10 things to do. As long as I do them, I'm golden, right? And it becomes sort of a very wooden sort of thing. And Bachman would say, no, actually these are illustrations meant to take you to that place where you remember that you belong to God, that these are examples, that are illustrations of what it means to live that out. Now, with these illustrations in mind and dedicated to that principle, you look at whatever, I'll say immigration, and you use this then as a way to begin to think about immigration in the 21st century. Right? So he'll make the point, say, in verse 9, which is a lot where we'll focus. He'll say, really, okay, which is what you have to do. I live in Colorado Springs. I don't know many people that own fields the edges of which they're tempted to be to totally harvest. Right? I don't know anybody like that. So in its most literal, it's not applicable. Right? Now, if you're in a rural place and you have the poor and the sojourners that tend to walk through your fields, that might be relevant. But in many rural places, the poor and the sojourners aren't even walking through your fields. So his basic, and this may be basic Bible interpretation, but he lays the ground for this. I want to kind of honor where he's going with this. I don't mean to be too obvious. But this idea in this text, I'm the Lord your God. We belong to him to be his people, and he to be our God, means then to live out our life according to his character. And these are illustrations of how that character is played out in Israel at this time. So that he would say that lays the groundwork for then thinking about any political situation. If you go to the Bible to discern how to think politically, and the Bible has all sorts of political implications in it, then there's a hermeneutic or a process that's more helpful than less helpful, right? To go to my favorite verse and then go loud and long based on the last website I saw is not probably what he would say is the best way forward. Yeah. You say, let's begin with a common way of reading the scriptures so that we can know the mind of God, so they can then inform us as we look at different situations. I know it seems obvious, but I'm not sure it's obvious in implementation in our society.
So the text is the key piece. Theme of I'm Lord Your God. And there will be spend particular time in 9 to 17 and in 9 and 10 in particular. 9 to 17, there is cultic illustrations in here, how to worship. There are social illustrations in here. There are a few legal illustrations that are popping up in here. But again, we're trying to focus our time a little bit. We're going to go to the social implications. And I think they might be the most relevant. And again, I might be totally projecting, though. And this is the funny thing. One of his principles is not taking sort of your favorite topic and making the scriptures fit your favorite topic, but to find the topic you're concerned about, then let the scriptures form your mind as you think about the topic. But it is always natural to sort of think about what's important to us and then go to the scriptures for justification. He would say that the scriptures will inform, but they may or may not justify your particular take, which of course is a very judicious thing, right? So Trinity, we talk about, Holy Trinity, we talk about. I honestly don't care if you get your news that night from NPR or MSNBC or Fox, as long as you read your Bible first, right? If you go to these places having first read your scriptures, then we have to trust each other to deal with any sources of information, our favorites or our most hated, in light of what the scriptures say. If the scriptures are our first filter, then we're in the right place, right? If I'm saturated with either MSNBC or Fox, and then I read the scriptures, we've got the wrong sequence. Can we all agree on that at least, right?
Yes.
As believers.
Yeah,
Nathan, does that?
No, totally. It's statistically, though, we spend so much more time. The quantity, I think, matters big time. Most of us spend an hour minimum on some kind of media. I mean, way more.
Yeah.
It's not the Bible.
Super interesting, right? I mean, I can tell anecdotally, I cringe when someone says to me, man, I get up and the first thing I do is I put on Choose Your Station.
Yeah.
Right? And then the wife says, and he listens to it all day. And I'm kind of like, oh. So yeah, it's an important point. So I guess as leaders, if we can learn some of these principles and begin to play them out for our people, it'll be helpful. Yeah, Donald.
Well, I was just going to say this. Thank you, and if I understand you well, that what it seems to me that the Lord, through Moses, is doing here is framing a worldview for them that's otherworldly, through which then they can engage life as people, which is we do it the other way around. We're already formed by the politics of our world, and we seek to read the Bible through the lenses of the politics of politics,
right,
and corrupt them for ourselves. But here, if I understood you right, these are the lenses through which we can engage our world.
Yeah. Well, the primary lens is who are we dedicated to for first and foremost?
The Lord.
The Lord, our
God.
This is who we belong to,
the Lord,
and He is our God.
Yes.
And then these are examples of how that plays out.
Yeah.
And they're meant to give us then, to help us with from these examples, learn how to think like God thinks, basically, and then move forward. So if in the Bauckham notes then, and at the top, if it is true, we can talk about it. If we can talk about it, we can talk about it well. That may or may not actually happen, but it's got to be possible for believers, right? I mean, if it's true on the ground, we've got to be able to identify and talk about it, no matter what it is. Anything has to be able to be talked about if it's true. Having said that, if we're going to talk about it as believers, we've got to believe that we have to be able to talk about it well. Now, it doesn't always come that way, but it seems like facts on the ground, that has to be what we as Christians would say, right? Guided by the Holy Spirit.
What are we talking about?
Anything. Pick something. What is true?
That's a good question.
Right?
What's true?
Right. Well, let's. What is true? Syria. I'll pick a topic. All right. Go ahead and put myself out there. Hafez. The Syrian president gassed the children gassed his own children in his own country. That's a fact on the ground, right? My blood pressure goes up a little on that one. But at least, you may think that that's a valid move on his part, right? Because he had insurgencies and they're related to the enemies or whatever. But so I can say, I have to be able to say that because it's true. And you have to be able to go, well, Matt, you're right. That is true. So if it's important, then let's talk about that. Or let's talk about LGBTQ, right? There are people who think, again, I'm betraying my biases, who are, I would say, deeply confused about their gender identity. Or let's do it the other way, who identify with a gender that doesn't match their genetics. That is true. Now then, that confuses me. But does that mean then I go, not talking about it? The fact is, it's true. So I have to then go, all right, this is true. So therefore, it has to be able to be talked about, right? Just at that level. Now then, at that, then we talk about, if it's true, how do we talk about it well? Now we're talking about how to lay out data, how to listen to people, how to receive well, how to speak when we speak through a biblical lens, this kind of thing. But when, too often I think we start out with, maybe fear. It's true, but I'm not going there. Or not very good assumptions, right? I don't know. The moon was really just a little plastic miniature terrarium, like the moon landing, right? Well, we gotta get, that's not even true. So we gotta figure that one out first. So, but if it's true, we can talk about it. If we can talk about it, we can talk about it well. And I guess just off the top of my head, and I want to make it more about Bach and not just my personal stuff, but I guess speaking about it well would be reflecting the fruit of the Spirit for Christians. Does a conversation reflect the fruit of the Spirit if we're believers? If you're not a believer, frankly, you don't have any obligation to speak by way of the fruit of the Spirit. But if you're a believer, it seems like we have to take on ourselves some sort of humble obligation about how to do this well. And so maybe the fruit of the Spirit is one of the ways to do that. So back to Bauckham. His book has a table of contents if you want to get the book. It's a short little read. It's terrific. Every word counts with him, though. But you can see issues in interpretation. And then he goes through various passages that deal with different politically charged topics, whether it's, again, holiness, wisdom for the powerful, songs for the oppressed, taxes, the fallenness of living in a broken world, Exodus and service related to slavery, nuclear holocaust, Jewish holocaust. So he picks some big pieces that he then approaches using his hermeneutic. If you want to go to those other chapters, they're really fascinating. His hermeneutic, he'll say that the issues in interpretation are the fact that there are varieties of Bible politics. Particularly, he makes the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The basic difference that he notes is that the Old Testament is a theocracy. It's a different thing to talk politically when you're a theocracy than it is to talk politically when you're a Christian society that exists within a broader cultural situation. When you set the cultural tone, both in law and morality and worship, that's a different cultural context than the United States of America, where we do not have a common set of values, much less worship, or even agreement top down on what all our laws are. So he'll say, first of all, you've got to take that into consideration when you deal with the scriptures. Then second, he'll talk about the problem of selectivity, which is what we just talked about. I can choose my favorite topic, I can find my six favorite verses, and I can go loud and long on that while not taking into consideration the entirety of the scripture, which he'll say is really important. He doesn't say that everything gets the same weight, okay? Not every verse gets the same weight, but every verse should be in the conversation at some point if you want to use the scripture as a way of dealing with politics. So not every verse gets the same weight, right? Don't sew wool and flax together. And thou shalt not kill. Well, if we're talking about gun laws, those two don't carry the same weight. But if there's something within the wool and flax thing that speaks to the broader context, it should have its voice, however appropriate, right? So that's a weird example, but there you go. Dispensational differences, again, sort of related to, this is related in many parts to the next one, which is salvation history. Where are we in the salvation history story as we read the scriptures and then see its illustrations and try and draw implications from it? To say at the very least that, say, fighting for your life in Canaan as a theocracy might have a different implication or inference than the 12 apostles who gave their lives, actually, happily gave up their lives for the proclamation of the gospel. In both cases, Bogdan would say that God's desires are being played out, but obviously in very different ways. The context, the conquest of Canaan was a different dispensation. Now, he would say that everything's okay. He would then say, though, that it all then has to move this direction. But you recognize that they're not talking about exactly, you're not in the same place in salvation history when you're conquering Canaan than you are when you're dedicating yourself to Jesus who died on the cross and gave you his spirit. Does that make sense? The one may lend towards a much more self-sacrificial, non-violent understanding. The one may lend itself towards a more triumphalistic understanding. And that you have to recognize that these are unique situations. They relate in the way then that Jesus fulfills the entire picture. So I don't get to say, yeah, Canaan, those are my guys. I want to go in and kick butt all day. Right? I don't get to say that. I get to say, clearly God implemented his plan in a violent way. Some would say that it was clearly reflecting God's character. Some would say partially. Some would say it wasn't, and it's put in the Bible as a negative example. But either way, I have to acknowledge that, but then go, but the king of this died on the cross, and has told me to pick up that cross. So when I'm tempted to go, yeah, conquer Canaan, I have to go, oh, cross. Right? And yet, victory is not a bad word in the Bible. Do you see how these things play? And how we have to take, so the dispensations count. Using the Old Testament today, one of the key pieces he would talk about is it being instructive, but not instructions. So let's go to our gleaning to the end of your field example. Again, I have a backyard. The only people that glean in my backyard are like the squirrels. nobody is going through my backyard by way of a poor person or a sojourner. So it can't be an instruction. I mean, if it was an instruction, I guess I'd have to go buy a field or something and grow stuff and have people come through. But it is then instructive by way of giving me an example, right, a picture, an illustration. Here's God's character. Here's an illustration of that. I belong to him. So now then my field would be my savings account, my 401k, my volunteer time and efforts. Do my efforts. And when I was a consultant, frankly, my wife kind of called me out on this. I worked stupid hours for people like Oracle Corporation, right? Stupid hours and they paid me pretty good, but to help them. And Lauren's like, you're working like 22 hours a day for Oracle. Now, I love that they're paying the bills, but what if you worked 8 hours a day for them, or even 10, and then you worked another 2 or 3, 4, whoever, right? And so is that an example of me not working to the very edge of my fields with my time and my expertise? I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, right? The Old Testament applies as instructive. So what's instructive to me is not using all of my skills and abilities and resources just to benefit me. Right? And is there a way to do that? He would also talk about typical, within that then sort of personal and political ethics. Can I have the same forgiveness for an individual if he has offended me personally, as I can if I'm a judge and I'm judging his situation with another person. And I'm under the laws of the land. Do I have the same right? Do I have the same call to forgive him as if he had offended me personally? And yet I'm now in a position of being a judge in the court. Luther used this one, where the idea of forgiveness, my personal forgiveness to him, would then contravene other ethical laws of God's, such as justice, recompense, and that kind of thing. So how do we balance those things? Personal versus political ethics. Christian society versus the world. Is there a place to say, well, they're not believers, so of course they don't act like believers, and we shouldn't expect them to act like believers? Is there a place for that? So the Quakers, the Amish, one of them would say, if you're not part of the Society of Jesus, well, nobody expects you to act like the Society of Jesus, so we don't judge you for not acting that way. And in fact, if you're a warrior, we're actually okay with you not acting that way. I think that's a dicey stretch, to tell you the truth. So does Bauckham. Bauckham finds that to be a little dicey. If he's the king of the universe, then his being part of his character applies not just to us, but to all his creation, even if it's a broken creation. But also recognizing, though, say when people come into our churches, you know, a brand new convert who used to be a pimp may come in with some pretty raw language even after the day he's converted. And so you do say to yourself, give him some grace, right? You don't unlearn crummy habits the day after you're converted. I haven't learned some decades after I was converted. And yet at the same time, it's not that we say, oh, well, that's just the way he is. There's no sanctification to be had. Same thing societally, Bauckham would offer. He would say we have to have some grace and patience and let God work in a society that isn't Christian anymore, I would offer. At the same time, though, recognizing that the goal, the arc of it, is for his character to be played out fully in all circumstances. So far, so good? Is this, are we too tedious, or do we need to, how is this working? Is this helpful, or is it not so helpful?
It is.
Okay, all right. Then very quickly, these are sort of standard Bible interpretation ideas. Text and context, right? You take into as you read the scriptures, you think about its place within the whole Bible, within the book itself, and then within your own passage, which is what this is meant to help us do. You think about pre-canonical contexts, and then canonical contexts. That simply means, say, we have a hint that a psalm was written, we have a hint of where it was written historically, that it may have then been written before the psalms were gathered together as a whole, right? And that both of those go into how we understand what that psalm might be implying. The latter one being the most important. So here you say the Bible as guided by the Spirit and organized in a final way, that's our main context, right? But it's legitimate to, if we know something about the pre-canonical context, before it became the canon, before it became organized, if we know something of it, that should have a voice in the conversation. Not as good of a voice as the final form of it, but a voice. And if we don't know, and he goes, that's tricky though, because a lot of that is just guesswork. Right. It's just guesswork. You don't really know. So if a source theory and form theory and stuff makes you nervous, Bauckham would say there's a place for it, not equal with the traditional understanding of the church over the centuries, right? But when it can be helpful to understanding the whole context so that we can accurately infer what's happening, then that's appropriate. But what you wouldn't say, and I think this may be where your mind's going,
Donald. That's what I'm...
He wouldn't say, let's do form criticism entirely, right? Yeah. Or source criticism. Because what happens there is you take apart the TV and you have all the parts laid on the table, but it's a big so what? Because you don't have a TV anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
But he would say, but if you lay out the parts and there's a part there that's helpful to understanding this bigger piece, allow it in the conversation. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the contemporary context. And he's pretty keen on being knowledgeable, just really if you want to understand a contemporary context, do your homework, right? Kind of get as many sides of the story as you can without going, you know, nuts, because there's any more, we have 50 sides to every story. But at least have a fully orbed view of your topic. And if you have a particular opinion, at least know the other pieces of the argument, right? At least be aware. Do the integrity work with your contemporary situation. So these are the pieces, and he would say, that are tools to allow us to begin to approach a number of societal and in particular political issues, and then in the, our contemporary situation, as well as we can, think, speak, act in ways that reflect God's character. Right? Whew. It's a lot easier to just get on your favorite blog. But to belong to Jesus and to be submitted to the scriptures, it's work. It is. But as Christian leaders especially, man, we've got to be committed to this work, I think. We've got to be committed to this work. So far so good? I don't think I've said anything great. Anybody want to chip in on any thoughts, comments?
I think Matt, what you're saying too is this is how children learn, you know, by watching us.
Mm-hmm.
So that how we respond to these situations and how do we answer through this hermeneutics that you played out, that's how they learn.
Yep.
I mean, they listen to us some of the time, but they're always watching us. So people need flesh and blood examples of how the way of the Lord affects everything.
I would say not just children, but our, well, if we're spiritual fathers and mothers, as
yes.
people do stuff,
yeah.
our parishioners, right?
Yeah.
You better believe that your parishioners are looking, when the topic comes up, you better believe that they're listening to what you say and how you say it and what your thinking is.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
What you say, how you say it, and how you got there. Mm-hmm. So for people like me that sometimes only have one neuron between my brain and my mouth, it's not always positive, because sometimes what's thought is said, and I need a few more neurons between my brain and my mouth, so my brain can process this way, and then my mouth can speak well. But yeah, Tony, that's exactly right. I promise you, in these days, your people are listening to what you say, how you say it, and how you got there. I promise. For any person of influence in the church.
Can I chip in?
Nathan, question? Please, yeah.
I mean, I would just say from my experience as a younger dude, that a lot of it has to do with not assuming that just because you're a priest or in the church or a leader in the church that people know you come to your conclusions biblically. Because to your formation piece earlier about, like, where we forming ourselves in the Bible first and then taking that into the political realm or the public square. Most people live in the political sphere, the public square, and they bring that stuff into the Bible. And so, like, you can't just assume, my own experience that I've learned the hard way is that I think have sometimes in some conversations assumed that as I'm sharing an opinion or thought or whatever, that someone will understand that I've arrived at that biblically, but that's not always the case, because if it happens to align on some level with some other political party, they go there first.
Oh, sure.
The assumption is that you're operating also out of some kind of political category instead of out of biblical categories. And so for me, I have had to learn to be much more explicit, to your point about how you got there.
Mm-hmm.
I had to really learn that. How do I be more explicit? And so to start, like, every conversation, if it's going to go there, to say something along the lines of, you know, I really think the Bible teaches, or I think the Bible
mm-hmm.
says,
yep.
And to be able to know that in yourself, where that is, has been so important.
That's a great point. Because I would have to confess, I sometimes would instantly put someone in a cubbyhole based on a language or a phrase they might use, and maybe not give them the credit for that. That's a great point. So you can, so you've like taught yourself to maybe give.
Teaching yourself. I mean, unfortunately nowadays when you preach, they're either going to put you in either one or two political camps.
Yeah.
I mean, that's they're gonna, that's what they do.
So we have to learn, we can't expect them to give us the benefit of the doubt. We have to learn to express ourselves in such a way that shows them the more nuanced view. I'm sorry, I got cut you off.
No, that's, I mean, but through the Bible.
Right.
I mean, we just talked about biblical justice, and that's very different from what the world wants.
Right.
I think there's a way to, one of the things I dread as a pastor is to appear to be activistic on the pulpit. Because when I'm on the pulpit, I think that my agenda is the agenda of the kingdom.
Amen.
But because the lived realities of the people intersect with the kingdom and with natural life, I speak into that. But our starting point must be how then does this inform their realities in terms of God's will for their lives. And ultimately then, if the big risk for me is to get into those issues and then end it there or stop there.
Mm.
Somehow there's got to be a leeway from there to connecting it into God's will, ultimately for the kingdom. And the other thing too is, I think if the church can offer anything that's either different or higher or better than what the world offers, then we have to come at it from the perspective of what the Lord is looking to offer to our lives, irrespective of the brokenness. Because there's never, the Messiah is not going to come from the White House or from any. God is at work in our world, in spite of our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Bauckham, I'll just kind of riff off of that if that's okay. Bauckham would totally affirm that. He would offer that, what we all know about, that sort of the now, not yet, that we are a people with an end times vision, right, that we want to orient everything towards, recognizing that we're in an in-between times twice, and that orientation may look clumsy, incomplete, clumsy and incomplete. And so he would even say that in these days, there's a place for the word that everybody hates, compromise. That as believers, we have this vision ahead of us that honestly, we're not gonna make the leap this side of heaven, or certainly not today. So in humility, are there places to compromise today that move the ball towards that goal, but isn't that goal entire?
I think that's a huge topic, man.
Yeah.
That is so hard because...
It is big, yeah.
Ethically, it's very difficult. And I totally get what you're saying. Let's take... I'm just gonna throw a skunk on the table
here.
So let's take an issue like abortion,
where
you essentially have two camps within the anti-abortion group. You have complete abolitionists that will settle for nothing but we outlaw the practice, except maybe in the most extreme circumstances. And then you have others that are saying, hey, look, I don't like abortion, but maybe we can compromise with pro-choice people and enact a law that will result in less abortions. And so there's kind of this practicality or this utilitarian impulse there that's not wholly evil or anything. It's towards a good goal. And then the abolitionists will come back and say, well, no, you're compromising with evil.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I get that on so many. I think, you know, that's the controversial, obvious example, but that can just filter down into so many different areas. And I find that to be very difficult to parse out in my own life, because I also go back to the idea of witness and complete truth telling as part of being a gospel shaped person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just reading in Acts when, you know, the apostles get taken in front of the council and they're like, I have to obey God rather than men. And they're not willing to compromise. They're just like, hey, just stop talking about Jesus for a while.
Right.
Let things settle down. Just stop talking about Jesus for a while. They're like, no, I'm not going to stop for a while.
Right.
We have to obey God rather than men. No compromise. I struggle with both of those a lot.
And yet Paul was willing to be led over the wall at night in a basket instead of like turn or burn.
I don't know. I don't know if that's compromise or just like, you know, running for it.
Or what's wisdom? Or what's well? Well, then, what's comp? Well, and well, then take that to the that to the abortion argument.
Yeah.
What part of that is compromise, and what part of that is wisdom? Don't know.
I think it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult to figure out. That's what
I think. Yeah, I think it's difficult. And
it is hard.
The role of the when we think about it, the role of the pastor and the role of the politician. If I was a politician. In the house, and there's a vote on the table, and the vote is trying to say, once the baby in the womb is 6 months old, in the womb, once the pregnancy is 6 months, you cannot commit abortion. So does that mean you can commit it in 3 months? That's basically what it's saying. It's giving
right.
an out,
right.
but to not vote that. As a politician,
right.
means you get nothing. So,
right.
so it doesn't mean you want the baby aborted
right.
in 2 months, but that's the bill I have on the table.
Right.
Which is, so to not vote that, I lose everything. That's the way a politician will think. But then a pastor would frame it a little differently, because the problem in front of me is not as much the bill as it is to provide a worldview
for life.
Yeah. For sure.
And you understand.
Yeah.
So it's
So can each one be faithful?
I think so. It's hard.
Yeah.
It is hard. What the question I think in your question is, by trying to be as faithful. Because faithfulness in this case is really based on the options you have on the table.
Okay.
So your options are what you're trying to be faithful to, but it's not absolute faithfulness in a sense. But then the abolitionists or whatever will criticize you. So
yes.
even within your camp, you're split.
Yeah,
that,
and I also think like we give, I completely agree with you. Let's create the worldview piece, the formation piece, like has to happen. That is the absolute bedrock of all of this.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And I do think as pastors, we have a special responsibility in that. But
yeah.
I also wonder about the role of the church within the broader society and our role within the public square, and whether or not that is really to offer, or whether or not the whole church has a priestly role, as it were, in the public square to do some of that formation and stuff too. In other words, like I just think sometimes there's a double standard between, well, pastors, you need to be concerned with worldview, and since I'm not a pastor, I can entrench in a particular position, but you can't. Does that make sense? You guys follow
yes.
So in other words, like
you.
like you are not allowed to have a political opinion as a pastor, but I can. I find that kind of weird, you know? Or you have a responsibility to form people, but I don't, because I'm not a pastor. But you kind of are, aren't you? Like, as a lay person,
absolutely.
You
yes.
kind of are a pastor.
Yes.
You kind of do have a priestly responsibility to the world.
God didn't say, I'm the Lord your God, just the ordained.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. This living out of this hermeneutic does form.
Yeah.
It is formation.
Formative.
It is formative.
This is a little different, but if you go to page 5 of 10 of the notes, just an example. I don't mean, and I'm not trying to cut this off anyway. I just think we're in a place that says, as leaders, okay, I go back to the scriptures, I go back to reading them well, and I lead and moderate these conversations. Now then, if you do fall on one, totally on one end, I guess you have to follow your conscience, right?
Yeah.
But I guess as leaders, we do want to ask ourselves, how did I get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did I do the hard work to get there?
Mm-hmm.
Am I just sort of venting my spleen? At the very least that. And if I can't get to one place, am I willing to live with my people's impatience when I'm
holding them in conversation and not letting us fall on one side or the other right away. Yeah, Tony?
I think sometimes too, the, you know, as a Christian, we can have our idea sort of, or our arguments sort of torpedoed and land in the lap of God. But if you're not a Christian and your identity is wrapped up in your politics, at that point to have your idea shut down is much scarier. Yeah. It's much more, a much bigger attack.
Right.
Because because your truth is being taken away from you, whereas we have a place, as a Christian, you have a place to land.
Yeah.
You know, you can lose the argument, or maybe not look so good, but your identity is somewhere else.
But you still belong to
the Father. At times it won't look that good.
Or you won't look, but if your identity is not in Christ, and your identity is in the argument that you're proposing,
that is terribly frightening.
It becomes terribly frightening, and that's why I think some people are so vigorous or so very quick to, you know, it becomes very emotional, very charged.
And so it really does put on us that a real animus of humility, doesn't it? To let them be mad at us, to let them not get it, to let them come back at us and not get it.
Yeah.
And us to sort of, like you were saying, Nathan, here's how I got here, here's where we're headed.
Yeah.
Either I... here's how I understand it, or here's where I get the conversation at the moment, right?
Yeah.
And we do have to sort of be ready to let people be upset with us.
Yeah, and we also need to probably find out when these issues themselves become a distraction from something else.
Yeah.
I was reading an article some months ago, and you know, there's this whole thing about justice and all that. But the correlation the study was finding is that many Christians who talk about, you know, injustice and all that happen to be some of the least givers to causes.
Interesting.
So, I only say that because it's and I'm not to bring condemnation on anybody, but how passionate we can be when it's someone anonymous, is it like government doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We get so passionate about it, but we're not passionate enough in our own lives to invest stuff from our own, you know,
to
help. So sometimes those can be outlets for us, you know, to satisfy ourselves. So I think talking about being formative, ultimately, I think that what this is saying is that we can't even learn to do it right until we ourselves have been shaped by God's word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ourselves.
Amen.
Yeah, and what, you know, when the whole issue of justice often is talked to in terms of only retributive justice, but not how God sees justice.
Proactive
or how
justice of grace.
As opposed to... how unjust unjust poverty really is in God's eyes.
Right, inequality, that's a great topic, right?
Yeah.
To be talked about from a biblical perspective. I think I'm ending towards our time to where we need to get to our next session. Let me do this. In your notes, what you've got are the little, I've tried to set up table contents of the book, kind of the list of the issues of interpretation, and then the rest of it, every little like chevron bullet point is a interpretation point, followed by notes that I think are relevant to that issue of interpretation. So all these notes are almost all quotes out of Bauckham's book. So if you want to go through them, you're welcome to. I apologize that they're not more complete. I apologize.
thank you for the outline.
But so each chevron is an interpretive principle,
yeah.
And the notes below it are an illustration of it. Thank you for carrying.
Can you get a digital copy of the outline? Do you think you can email that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to.
Awesome.
Can I ask you can I put it on you to contact me?
You can.
I kind of got Teflon brain. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Tough subject.
Yeah, it is.
Good job, man.
It's something I've been wanting.